Good morning. Today I will speak about reported pertussis-related deaths to the National Notifiable Disease Surveillance System and CDC in the U.S. From 2000 to 2005. And for those of us who are forgetting what pertussis sounds like, so, pertussis was a major cause of illness and death in children in the U.S. This slide shows the trend of reported pertussis in the U.S. from 1922 to 2005. Reporting of pertussis began in the early 1920s. Notice that the number of annually reported cases declined steadily over the years from 265,000 approximately in the mid-1930s to an all-time low of 1,010 cases in 1976. And this was especially dramatic after the introduction and widespread use of DTP vaccines in the mid-1940s, when universal childhood vaccination started. Also noticeable is a gradual increasing trend since 1977, from about just over 1,000 cases to 25,000 cases in 2004 and 2005. These levels have not been seen since 1959, 1960. The trend over the last 25 years, from 1980 to 2005, is shown in the insert graph. And bear in mind that this is occurring in spite of high vaccination coverage in the US, which is currently at an all-time high of about 95% for the primary series. Pertussis was not only a major cause of morbidity, as shown here, but also resulted in a significant number of fatalities, especially in children. In this slide, the trend of reported pertussis deaths is shown for the period 1922 to 2005. Reported annual mortality trends from pertussis closely parallel that of reported cases, as shown in the slide. Note the high number of reported deaths in the pre-vaccination era from the early 1920s. After the introduction of DTP vaccine in the mid-1940s, similar to cases, there was a dramatic decline in reported pertussis deaths in the US. In the inset graph, the annual number of reported deaths is shown for the period 1980 to 2005. During the period 1980 to 1999, a total of 181 deaths were reported. Note that during the 1990s, there appeared to be an upward trend in reported deaths. The objective of this presentation is to describe the epidemiologic trend and characteristics of pertussis-related deaths in the US during the period 2000 to 2005. We identified fatal cases of pertussis using data from the National Notifiable Disease Surveillance System for the reporting period. To obtain additional information on fatal cases, we reviewed case report forms, medical records whenever available, including hospital discharge summaries, death certificates, and autopsy reports. A death was attributed to pertussis if patient records reveal that Bordetella pertussis was isolated from a clinical specimen by culture, or the case was clinically compatible with pertussis, meaning that there was respiratory illness with cough and with or without a whoop, paroxysms, post-tussive vomiting, and apnea, with either a positive PCR test or epidemiological linkage to a lab-confirmed case. And for deaths, we also included positive DFA test results and autopsy findings that were consistent with pertussis. During the study period, a total of 140 cases were identified. 48% had positive cultures, 39% had positive PCR results, and 7% were epidemiologically linked to these lab-confirmed cases. In addition, 6% had positive DFA tests, and in one fatal case, there was a serologic result that showed highly elevated anti-PT IgG antibodies and was also included in the analysis. This slide shows the age distribution of pertussis deaths in the period 2000 to 2005 and makes a comparison with the 1980s and 1990s. The majority of deaths occurred in infants less than 1 year of age. There was a significant rise in the proportion of deaths that were among infants from 76% in the 1980s to 90% in the 1990s to 94% in the current study period. Note the lower number of pertussis deaths among children 1 to 4 years of age in the 1990s and in the 2000s. And this may be related to improving childhood immunization coverage. We looked at infant pertussis deaths in a little more detail. And here we notice that of the 131 infant fatalities, actually all were below 6 months of age. Almost half were in infants less than 28 days of age. Two-thirds of the infants were less than 6 weeks of age and therefore were not eligible for even accelerated vaccination. 84% were below 60 days of age and were too young for routine immunization with DTaP. And 98% were less than 90 days. 2% of cases were between 120 to 180 days of age and were available for one or two doses of vaccine. Although there was no significant trend in the annual reporting by gender, overall more deaths occurred in females, 54% as compared to 46% in males. Overall, about 45% of deaths were among Hispanic infants or Hispanic ethnicity, 51% non-Hispanics, and in 4% of cases, the ethnicity was unrecorded or unknown. Of infants did not receive or were not even eligible for a dose of vaccine. In three cases, or 2% of infants, one or two doses of vaccine was administered. And in four cases, the vaccination status was unknown. However, three of those infants were too young to receive vaccination, and one case was in a 60-day-old infant. The gestational age of these infants was known for 101 infants, and about 39% of these infants were born before 37 weeks of gestation. Most fatalities occurred in otherwise previously healthy persons. Non-infant deaths had pre-existing medical conditions, and in six fatalities, the conditions listed were dementia, multiple myeloma, myelofibrosis, neuroblastoma, multi-organ dysfunction syndrome, chronic emphysema, among others. The mother's age was known for 94 cases, and the median age was 22 years, with a range of 13 to 47 years. So how did the infants become infected? The source of infection was reported for 73 of 131 infants. As shown in this slide, a member of the household, either the mother, the father, a sibling, or grandparent, or a close relative, had prolonged cough illness and was probably the source of infection. Two infants acquired pertussis while in a healthcare facility from the time of birth without even going home. All cases developed severe respiratory difficulties, and 94% required hospitalization. During hospitalization, elevated white blood cell counts and lymphocyte counts were prominent features. 35% of hospitalized infants developed pulmonary hypertension, which was severe, rapidly progressive, refractive to inhaled nitric oxide therapy. And mechanical ventilation or assisted ventilation was required in about 72%. Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation was required, or ECMO was required, in 40 of the 131 infant cases, or 30%. Reported complications were pneumonia in 92% of infants, seizures. This would be all cases. The pneumonia in 92% of all cases, seizures in 10%, and in 8%, and encephalopathy in 5% of cases. Other pathogens were also isolated from 39 cases. The isolated pathogens and their frequency are shown in this slide. Respiratory RSV was the most common co-infection, influenza virus, adenoviruses, parainfluenza viruses, CMV, Pseudomonas, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, and others are some of the listed co-infections. In conclusion, pertussis causes serious illness and death among infants in the U.S. Reported infant deaths increased during the period 2000 to 2005, particularly in infants who were too young to start or complete the primary vaccination series before 6 months of age. A parent, sibling, grandparent, or close relative with prolonged cough illness at home was the most important known source of exposure to pertussis. We recommend that strategies should be implemented to prevent infant pertussis deaths. Additional prevention strategies are required to prevent pertussis and deaths in infants who are too young to start or complete primary vaccination. Booster vaccination of adolescents and adults with Tdap may reduce the risk of exposure to pertussis in young infants. Tdap vaccination should be given to individuals, especially parents, household members, healthcare workers, who are likely to come in close contact with a newborn. In this regard, it is important to motivate both parents and providers about Tdap vaccination through well-planned, sustained education programs. Risk factors for infant pertussis deaths need further evaluation. Currently, there's a study of factors relating to severe pertussis in neonates in progress, and there's another study looking at factors associated with a fatal outcome, which is also in progress. I wish to acknowledge the following persons at CDC, Christine Brown, Drew Bowman, Tom Clark, Kashif Iqbal, Pam Srivastava, and the numerous staff from the various reporting state, county, and city health departments, and reporting hospitals. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Tej, and thanks to all three presenters for very interesting presentations. We'll open the floor for questions or discussion. Please use the microphones if you can. And maybe I'll start with a question for Cindy. I guess in light of the changes in the Oregon recommendations, could you comment on use of PEP to control the outbreak in Arkansas and the extent of prophylaxis prescriptions?
I do know that what really struck me is the comment that, you know, children and members of the family were being prophylaxed over and over and over again, and it was very frustrating and expensive for people to do that. So I think it's really interesting to look at that kind of approach, because that was definitely one of the things that had been brought up during the outbreak investigation, and perhaps that would be, you know, helpful. I mean, to really look at that kind of approach and do this type of evaluation in other places, because it really addresses one of the main concerns that people had. And it made the investigation difficult, because by the time we got there and we wanted to try and culture samples, you know, people had already received multiple courses of antibiotic, and so it really made an investigation of the outbreak challenging at that point as well.
Great, thank you. Microphone.
Hi, I'm Cynthia with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I know that our recommendations for control, our guidelines are kind of in between CDC's and yours as far as how much prophylaxis we do. What did you notice, because you removed prophylaxis from the household unless there was an infant, is that correct?
Right.
Did you see much secondary transmission after doing that?
That's correct. We removed the household prophylaxis unless there was an infant or a pregnant woman. In the evaluation, we found out that all the secondary cases had symptoms before the onset of the investigation of the primary case began. So it was our public health intervention is late.
Okay. Yeah, and when are you hearing about them? Is it right around?
We're not
two
hearing
weeks?
Anything. I mean, anytime that we wanted to hear from our counties, because anytime we talk with CDC, at the time Margaret Cortez was on board, the question that she had for us, how are your counties feeling with a new guideline? Are you seeing more secondary cases? Are high-risk people getting prophylaxis in a timeline fashion? So these were our main questions. And we were really worried when we changed, because we thought we might make things worse. Who knows? And one of the reasons that we showed that red arrow is trying to show you guys visually is that we didn't make things worse. And maybe another coincidence is our pertussis was going down at the time. In 2004, when we used the old guideline, right, we had explosion pertussis in Oregon. Many, many outbreak case related. And you know, at the time, we have active case finding by the local health department, testing a lot. In 2005, pertussis was kind of going down and more sporadic cases. But no, we're not seeing secondary cases. We're not hearing from our local health department. Initially, we didn't have private providers on board, because it's kind of scary saying we're not prophylaxis because you're considered low risk. But as time is going by, we're getting more private providers on board. And of course, our guideline is for local health departments. We're not asking private providers to follow that. But we had only positive feedback so far.
Okay.
And we had our counties on the board. We did everything in partnership with them.
Yeah. We developed some more guidelines with our counties as well. But anyway, and then I have one other question. Tej, why did you decide to include positive DFAs?
No, we don't include.
Oh,
no.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I wasn't clear enough.
Yeah, we included positive DFAs. It's not. I know DFA is not one of the tests that is recommended by the CST for. But we reviewed the clinical history of these cases, and they were very, very compatible with pertussis, and the only way that they were, the only lab test that was actually done was DFA. And then there was also epi-linkage to household members with chronic cough. So we thought it was maybe useful to include them in the series.
I had a question for Tej and Tom about the recent epidemiology of pertussis and the encouraging decrease in cases in 2006, and I haven't really heard the final numbers for 2007. Since this is the pertussis session, maybe you want to talk about that. But and conjectures about when can we say that TDAP may be a cause for the recent decrease, as opposed to just a cyclical pattern. Do you want to address that at all? Since this is the pertussis session, it seems like a good.
Yeah, well, one thing I think is certain, that the decrease in 2006, it's too premature to say it was because of use of Tdap, because we know certainly that Tdap is not, the uptake of Tdap is not as great as we would like. So we do not think it's because of the use of the new vaccine, whether it's cyclical or not. It could be because we have had major outbreaks in many states in 2004, 2005, 2003. And it could be that the susceptibles in those states have actually been burnt out. So we probably over the next few years, we'll be able to assess what the impact of Tdap has been. Yeah.
Yeah, and we are seeing a little bit of a decline in the 2007 numbers. I'll look to Pam to nod and tell me that's right. I think, yep. So yes, numbers are going down, probably, as Tej said, more related to accumulation of susceptibles or and then mm-hmm. burning through those with incidence and transmission, and so the normal waxing and waning patterns. Mm-hmm. TDAP coverage from the NIS teen survey was sort of around 12% from 2006 mm-hmm. into early 2007. So sales and uptake of vaccines are somewhat better than that, but we're probably a long way off towards high coverage. And then we don't yet, so we have studies ongoing of TDAP effectiveness, including in outbreak settings, but we don't yet know the real world effectiveness of TDAP. But we certainly do know that the pertussis vaccines in general are not among the most highly effective mm-hmm. vaccines, mm-hmm. and so we still have transmission in highly vaccinated childhood populations, mm-hmm. so presuming we'll still have transmission in adolescent and adult populations. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I will say adult vaccinations, we have no estimates of coverage yet and probably can assume that that's not very good.
Mm-hmm. And one last question, as far as TDAP use, what is the amount of time that folks are using from their last TD for people to get a TDAP? Or are you using any exclusion, like you had to have at least 2 years, or are you saying in an outbreak situation you can get TDAP even if you've had recent TD? What are folks using as their guidelines?
Yeah, I think in the recommendations, an interval is short as 2 years.
So they're using the 2 years. Okay.
But that being said,
I was wondering in the real life.
Yeah, the results from I think also in the same MMWR it was stated that the results from some of the trials that were or studies that were done in Canada that shown mm-hmm. that you could use as short as 6 months.
Right. Well, I was wondering in real life if people are sticking with 2 years or if there's.
I think in real life there's confusion, and so and we probably contributed to that. So the 5 year and 2 year recommendations are more based on available data, and sort of not going to less than 2 years were based on absence of data. Mm-hmm. And so the concern is not immunogenicity at all, but potential for increased mm-hmm. local reactions. And we have a couple of large experiences now with. In outbreak settings with vaccination using no chosen interval, and we're not seeing more mm-hmm. adverse events. So mm-hmm. comfortable that that intervals should not be the primary deciding factor.
Hi, I'm Mark LaForce from the Meningitis Project. I just want to make sure I understand things in terms of the Arkansas epidemic. These are all vaccine failures, right? By my definition, it's a failure.
Then I guess you could consider okay. it a failure, but they were all vaccinated, on time, right
correct.
Intervals. But the nature of the vaccine is that it's not 100% effective. So even in this highly vaccinated population, you still have a pool of susceptibles
right.
that...
Okay. One point for Dr. Tiwari. The evidence then would suggest that there's continued circulation of Bordetella pertussis, even in highly immunized groups, to account for this burst of cases. My question is, and forgive me if I just haven't kept up with the literature, but have there been sort of community-based carriage studies of Bordetella pertussis comparing the rates of carriage after wholesale pertussis vaccine, that is the old vaccine, versus the new acellular pertussis? Thank you.
Yes. As far as I'm aware, Bordetella pertussis is ongoing transmission even among vaccinated people. Infection is occurring. Disease is probably not occurring. I'm not aware of carriage studies. I don't know if Tom is aware of any recent one, but in the past there haven't because there is actually no carriage of Bordetella pertussis, excepting during that transient infection stage. But there is no long-term carriage, as far as I'm aware of. Not like meningitis and some of the other diseases.
Good morning. My name is Wanda Harden from Montgomery. I work in a fairly qualified healthcare clinics, so technically all of my patients are high-risk patients. But this year I've had two infants under 2 months of old with pertussis. And as I look back, there was never a good, no one ever came into our office and say, hey, the day this child was here 2 days before they were vaccinated, what was your population? Are there CDC or is that a state-to-state guidelines for follow-up in terms of exposure for pertussis? Is it a state-to-state or is that just a CBC set guideline?
For exposure to pertussis?
Yes. Exposure research in terms of containing an outbreak or preventing an outbreak when you have a diagnosis. A young child with a diagnosis.
Yeah,
see, my children were under the age of 2 months, so if they're sitting in the clinic for 8 months for 3 or 4 hours waiting to see our pediatricians and they're coughing or just there, then on that day, technically, I would think I've had at least 30 to 40 children exposed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was no one coming in and say, let me see your rostrum for the day before this child went into the hospital. So that's what I was wondering about your guidelines.
Right. And in a clinic situation, it would be a mother with a baby, a two-month-old baby, probably in her arms. If the baby coughs, I mean, the way pertussis is transmitted, it's true coughing. And usually, when a person coughs, there are droplets that are generated. And these droplets are projected for about, as far as the evidence goes, about 3 feet into the air, not much beyond that. So I would say people who are in the vicinity of 3 feet and less are probably the real exposed persons and not the whole clinic. And by and large, it's a state that determines, the state that actually has all the powers to investigate. We offer guidance to the states.
Hi, I'm Chaz DeBolt from Washington State. And a more and more frequent problem that we're encountering is that when we give early antibiotics, we actually do impact the course of the disease. And also with PCR diagnosis as opposed to culture, the turnaround time on the test is shortened. And so even if someone waits for a positive diagnosis to start antibiotics, the antibiotics are often started earlier in the course of the disease. And what we're experiencing is people who are PCR positive who don't meet the clinical case definition. And we have no way to report those according to the current case definition. And I just wanted to comment that I think Juventila's before and after study shows us that this is only going to become more and more of a problem because she's showing that with this focus on high risk, you're even having earlier intervention on high risk people that then may not meet the clinical case definition, but were confirmed by PCR and then are not reportable under our current CSTE case definition. So I just wanted to throw that out to everyone.
And that is a dilemma.
Yeah, I'll just comment too. I mean, completely agree. It's a problem, and we're still stuck with the necessity for 2 weeks of follow-up in order to comply with the case definitions as written, but better diagnostics that actually might let us impact transmission with earlier treatment. And I will say, too, we've had situations where PCR results sent us down the wrong path, and we've had situations where PCR results for pertussis were very useful and allowed us to respond early to outbreaks. And so we're also working on standardization and validation of PCR tests and tech transfer, basically, of those assays.
Just what we might consider is that these folks maybe should at least be considered probable pertussis.
Excellent presentations. One of the questions I was wondering is, have you been doing any studies in healthcare workers who've been vaccinated and the institutions have chosen to do surveillance as opposed to prophylaxis? Because it's a common question that we get in terms of control.
Yes, so we have we issued an RFA, and so Vanderbilt University is working on a field trial, basically, of vaccination only versus vaccination and normal practice for prophylaxis when healthcare workers are exposed to pertussis. Right. And we should have data sort of 18 months or so, I think, from that. They're in there well into their first year.
Oh, great. And just one other follow-up question to something you said earlier. You said that there has been, there's some data from some large outbreaks looking at Tdap with no interval. Could you expand on that? Because that's sort of my position in my state, but people still are reluctant to vaccinate.
Yeah, so one of our epidemiologists worked in a New Hampshire outbreak that's been published.
Okay.
And so large-scale vaccination of healthcare workers independent of interval and have data.
I'm familiar with that data.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks.